Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Larry Mays was born in Pierce, South Dakota in early 1968. He volunteered for the United States Air Force and entered officer training school. In 1969, he was promoted to first lieutenant and received orders to go to Vietnam. Larry later found himself on the edge of Saigon, supervising around 100 air freight specialists. He's now retired and lives in Rapid City. He's joining us now from Ellsworth Air Force Base on the line. Larry Mays, welcome.
Good morning, Lori.
Let's talk a little bit first about the sort of family background that you had that maybe contributed to your desire to serve in the United States military.
Well, I had my father and three uncles that served in World War II and another uncle that served during the Korean War. So there was certainly a history there.
Were there conversations you had growing up about why you should serve, and do you remember those?
Well, my Uncle George was at Saipan and Tarawa both.
Wow.
And he had some stories to tell. He didn't talk about it much, but sort of gave you the sense that he felt that the sacrifice that the men that he served with was noble and something we should all do. So I felt like I kind of had an obligation as his nephew, as well as all of my other relatives, to do my part.
So let's talk about this time when you decide to go in. How much do you know about Vietnam at the time? Where are we at in the war?
Well, I probably didn't know as much as I should have. I had been in college during most of the early parts of Vietnam, and I went to school at Northern. We didn't have a lot of protests up there, so I only heard what was generally in the news. I did have, in fact, one of the first South Dakotans killed in the war, Joe Thorne, was actually an acquaintance of mine as I was a little kid growing up in Gettysburg. So I had a sense that, you know, obviously there was a price to be paid for it, but I didn't have a great sense for what was going on strategically. I just knew that I'd only been in the Air Force 18 months when I got those orders, so I was still had a lot to learn about what was actually going on in the war. Didn't have a great frame of reference when I left for there.
Did you have reservations based on some of the protests you saw in the news, or was that just sort of background noise for what you knew you needed to do?
It was truly background noise. I didn't have any qualms whatsoever. I had been at a base that was closing, my first assignment, and it wasn't very challenging. And I felt like if I was going to stay in the Air Force for a career, which at that point I hadn't made a decision, this was something I was going to have to do. So there we went.
Give me an idea of your first experience in Vietnam. When do you arrive in country, and what's your job?
I arrived in country the end of November 1969. My job was to supervise all of the line loading of aircraft that were used for tactical airlift in virtually all of South Vietnam. We would get the fragmentation order for the day's shift of airplanes early in the evening. We would spend all night long loading those planes so in the first light they would be able to take off. They supplied all of the mostly Army airfields, very remote places, but places where you could land, like a C-7 Caribou or a 123, the larger field C-130s. So our job was to load those airplanes, and during the night we would also unload any airplanes that came in that were either late in the day. There wasn't a lot of tactical airlift being done at night, but occasionally it would occur. We also loaded and unloaded airplanes that were coming from the States, the large strategic airlift airplanes that were bringing things in from the States. So it was a 12 to 14 hour shift, busy all the time with forklifts and K-loaders, which is a machine that carried the various pallets to the airplanes. It's mostly just grunt work, loading and unloading airplanes.
All right, give us an idea what the difference between a tactical airlift and a strategic airlift is for those who don't quite know.
Well, the simple way to say that is tactical airlift takes the beans, bullets, and butts right to the airfields that are closest to where the action has taken place.
Okay.
Strategic airlift is more like what you think of when freighters carrying C-5s, the large cargo airplanes, carrying things from an airfield in the States to a large airfield like Tonson Oat was. to get it ready then to be broken down into smaller components that would go off to the airfields. Just a typical sorts of things that we carried, that we loaded. We loaded lots of cannons, helicopter blades, food, lots of food, ammunition, and then lots of troops. We would do troops movements from Tansanute out to the various places, both replacement troops and then unit moves. If we were going to have a campaign in a certain part of the country where we could send dozens or hundreds of troops over a period of a few hours out to those locations.
Did you get a sense, did you get to see those troops, talk to them? Did you have a sense of their morale or what they were feeling as they went from one place to another? Or is that not really something you got close to?
Actually, you did. Normally, as the officer in charge, I would be working with the movement specialist, which is normally an officer, an Army officer. And you had a chance to get to know them pretty well because the intricacies of loading and unloading transports and people and their equipment is pretty complicated. So you got to know them well. And my sense during the time I was there, the line units that were doing the actual out-on-the-ground combat were really high morale. They knew what they were about, and they were glad and proud to do that job.
All right, so I've flown on a C-130, and it's not super comfortable. But I'm sure they're configured internally in different ways. So tell me, how many people can get on one of these things at that time, and how are they sitting to make that transportation?
Well, there's two answers to that. The troop transports for Americans, they had a row of canvas seats down the center of the airplane and canvas seats along the side. Troop seats, I'm sure you're familiar with those.
That's how I remember
it. They could carry up to 100 fully armed, fully equipped troops, and maybe even a Jeep or two. Okay. But if we were moving the Vietnamese, we would simply put 5 empty pallets on the floor, and they would sit on those pallets, and you would have a 10,000-pound tie-down strap would go from one side of the airplane, kind of like a giant seatbelt that would go across the laps of 10 people wide all the way from the front to the back of the airplane. And I have seen over 200 people loaded that way.
Wow.
Not very comfortable, not very pleasant. And as you know, flying in those really warm, humid airplanes, it was rough. Yeah. Really rough. So by the time that airplane got where it was going, there were a lot of things on the floor that were not very pleasant.
I took one from Hawaii to Korea time. It takes some time,
that,
too. They're
know,
not super...
A lot of time in C-130s over the course of my career. It's certainly not flying first class.
I only had one time, and it was memorable. So good for... I admire you. Tell us a story of, I have been looking things up online, and there's quite a few different stories that you could tell. Certainly an interesting one about a motorcycle being loaded, dealing with the Korean or the Republic of Korean Army or Air Force there. You want to tell that story because it's so engaging?
Yeah, the Republic of Korea had a large contingent of forces, mostly up around Natrang, that served ground combat. They had a large airlift operation at Tansanute. We were in charge, but they had their own flights, and through a protocol that had been developed over years, they were given the authority to do all of their loading and unloading themselves, even though it was an American airplane with an American crew. One afternoon, I was on the flight line, got an emergency call that I needed to meet. The Korean airplane was diverting back into Tansanute with an emergency, and they needed an officer there to meet it and to deal with whatever the problem was. So I go to the airplane. I find out that the Korean load crew had put a motorcycle on the ramp pallet, laid it down on the ramp pallet, and it had gasoline in the tank. And as the airplane took off, it tilted enough to where the gasoline started to run out of that motorcycle and onto the floor. And then almost instantly, the fumes filled the entire airplane. Extremely dangerous situation. Right. So the crew diverted back into Tansanute. When they got landed and I got to the airplane, I saw immediately what the problem was, and I ordered the Korean crew to unload the airplane. About the time that I was finishing with my instructions to them, and a Korean major shows up. He is incensed. You can see he's really, really mad. And he walks up to me, and he pulls out his .45, and he sticks it right in my face. And he starts screaming at me in at least Hangul and perhaps English, and I don't know what other languages, and threatening to shoot me because obviously he had lost sense of face or pride over what was going on there, and he wanted to make sure that all of those people who were gathering around knew that he was going to get his revenge. And I seriously thought he was going to shoot me. So I just stood my ground and to let him get rid of his anger and frustration. That at some point, I think he realized that killing me wasn't going to solve this problem. He loaded his gun and left. A couple of days later, after I had filed my report about being not very happy with what happened, I get a call that there's an American officer who's going to come and do the investigation. He comes to talk to me, and it turns out he is Major Kim, the same name as the guy who was pointing that gun in my face, Kim, because I could read his name tag while I was looking at that gun barrel. And it turns out his American officer is also a Korean-American by the name of Kim, and I thought, boy, there's a coincidence. Aren't they related?
You're not going to get very far with your complaint then, are you?
Well, nothing ever happened that I know of, except that from that point onward, we always had somebody supervising the load crews, the Korean load crews.
Yeah, a million stories to tell, I'm sure. Let's talk a little bit, as we close up here, just about coming home. And particularly, I'm interested in the legacy of Vietnam in South Dakota. All these years later, looking back, what do you see that legacy as being?
Well, I think as I've gotten older, it's much easier to put it in a form of perspective. Because I stayed in the Air Force, I had a peer group that had also, many of them had been in Vietnam. So I had someone I could talk with that I could relate to or could relate to me about my experiences. So I didn't have any of the PTSD issues, or at least not very many, that some did. So I got through that transition without a lot of trouble. But now as I look back at it, I remember the names of the guys in my unit that were injured and killed. And there are names of three South Dakotans that will live in my memory forever. Chuck Lane, who was with me at Yankton College, or Tommy Leon Calise, who's from Howard, and Clifton Cushman from North Dakota. There were people that I knew, Air Force pilots, that are all currently MIA. And I think about those guys every day, despite the fact it's been nearly 50 years. I can see their faces, and I can remember the incidents at which they were lost. And it reminds me simply that the price was paid, and for those families and loved ones of those people, that price continues to be paid every day for those 58,000 who gave their lives.
We're talking with retired United States Air Force Colonel Larry Mays. And Colonel Mays, I'm wondering what your advice would be to young men and women who are looking at a career in the military now. What do you say to them?
Well, my son entered the Air Force in the early 90s, right as the first Gulf War was taking place, and he did 4 years as a dog handler. He had come out of high school, wasn't really sure what he wanted to do with his life, so he went into the Air Force. And that 4 years, he would tell you, were the best years of his life in terms of maturity, learning about what the life was really like, getting a sense of purpose. Now he has a college degree, a master's degree. He's in the Air Force Reserve, stationed at Carswell Air Force Base. He just came back from a six-month deployment to the sandbox. And it's turned him into a young man of whom I'm extremely proud. So I'm a real proponent of the military. I believe that military for both young people who want to go in and enlisted, even if it's just for a 3 or 2 or a 4 year tour, or want to do it for a career, it offers a tremendous opportunity to serve your country, to feel good about yourself. I have no qualms about what we do. I think the military is the single greatest representative of this nation worldwide of any entity of the United States.
How important is that peer group? We just have about 30 seconds left, but how important, you know, you mentioned PTSD, and obviously many people are coming home and suffering from that today. Is the peer group and sort of having that support really essential to being healthy during your time in the military and afterwards?
It's better now. I helped two young men who were in my organization during Vietnam battle with the VA a decade or so ago, trying to get help for PTSD from some of the things they encountered. And I was successful only through an enormous amount of effort, and having been a relatively senior officer, maybe my voice was heard a little bit more. But They had a hard time. Eventually were successful in getting their ratings and their back pay and all that. But it was a real challenge. I've seen a tremendous change for the better with the VA over the last decade, and certainly in the last couple years. And I believe the future is much brighter for the VA. Hmm. But there's certainly a legacy there. And we all, as citizens, have a responsibility to those young men and young women to make sure that they get the care they've earned when they come back, whether they stay in the military or they get out.
We'll leave it there. Retired United States Air Force Colonel Larry Mays, thank you so much for your service and for your time today.
Lori, thanks for your service, too. You and Chris both.